So I'd like to welcome everyone to this, the first of our Power of the Herd web symposium calls. And this one, we're going to be discussing chapter one, obviously, The Horse in My Cathedral. And of course, I'd like to welcome the author of the chapter and the book, Linda Kahanov. Hi, Linda. Welcome.
Hi, Mark. Great to be here.
And it's great to have everyone on the call. And also, thank you for all your questions and comments that have come in. And we shall hopefully get to those in due course. Right. So I'd like to start off with this concept of cathedral thinking, because this has resonated with a great number of people. I mean, I can just, I'd like to actually just quote from some of the comments that have come in. Joan, for example, said, I've never heard the term cathedral thinking before. It has really been resonating with me. Susan, in fact, says, Susan lives in Tuscany. She says, there is a sort of cathedral thinking tradition here, which involves the planting of olive trees. They are so central to the history and livelihood and countryside of Tuscany, but olive trees take a very long time to grow to full size. So planting them where farms are still often family-run affairs, it seems, is an act for the future, for the great-grandchildren, and so forth. So, and I had never come across cathedral thinking before, so I wonder whether you could just talk a little bit about that and how you came up with the concept, if indeed you did.
Well, cathedral thinking is a term that you can look it up on the internet. You can just type in cathedral thinking. And it really comes from the knowledge that in order to build a cathedral, even now with our modern construction equipment, you're talking around 150 years at least to build a cathedral. And so that means that people who were there working in the beginning, if they're at all realistic about their own mortality, they have no, they really have no ambition to see the finished product. I mean, it might be nice. They might be excited about it. But they realize that what they're doing is they're getting something started. They're nurturing a vision. And then they're handing it over to the next generation and possibly the next generation as a multi-generational project. So in some sense, to notice your place in the world and what nourishes you, and then also to have a vision that can be handed over to the next generation and the next, is, I think, a part of what is so great about being human, that we can be present now and we can look into the future and we can create visions that will be handed over to other people. I mean, people are always talking about what sets us apart from the other species on this planet, and that's one of the things that does set us apart, is the ability to hand a project over to the next generation. So cathedral thinking can be very comforting. I noticed that there was one of our listeners and people who wrote in comments on the first chapter who found the concept of cathedral thinking perhaps even a little bit overwhelming, because she was really concentrating on developing her career right now. And cathedral thinking doesn't necessarily demand that you look into the future at all times. I guess it's really asking us to look at both at the same time. What's going to nourish us right now? What garden are we actually tilling for this year's vegetables? And then what olive trees are we planting for the next generation? Both can happen at the same time.
Okay, and there's an interesting question came in from Larry, who said, if horses live in the present, how does the cathedral theory of passing things on, multi-generational, how does that relate to horse wisdom? Or is it that the leadership that they teach we as humans should be passed on?
So how do the sort
of, yeah, go ahead.
Horses do really live in the present, and so they help us to become highly functional in the present. But there is a way in which horses are evolving through their interactions with human beings. And so that affects future generations as well. So while they may not be concerned so much with planning for the future, they definitely evolve in coordination with us. So that what we do, if we have a cathedral thinking mentality about how we now begin to nourish horse wisdom in our lives, in the human world, let horses influence us for a change, because they are marvelous examples of non-predatory power, as we'll talk more about in this symposium. At the same time, I've noticed with my own herd is that as multiple generations are born into a herd where the horses are respected as teachers and co-facilitators and companions rather than as tools or as children, that each generation of horses that comes along here becomes smarter, becomes more personable, shows us things about horses that we could never have conceived of even just 50 years ago.
Yeah, and it seems to me that, and one of the phrases, again, I picked up from the first chapter, you talk about this modern quick fix mentality, and everything is instant. We have instant food and instant this and fast food, and the pace of life is so much, it's increasing year after year, month after month, or so it seems. And so it's almost like stopping this juggernaut of trying to speed everything up, where, you know, clearly horses are really not caught up on that particular hamster wheel. So how do we get to the to slow everything down and then start to look at things in with a lot more longer term perspective?
Well, I think that just the fact that we're sitting here now on this web symposium is kind of the ultimate quick fix. The fact that I can talk to you, Mark, in England, and we can have people from all over the world listening to us. And there are real advantages to what we've created in this sphere. It frees up time, ultimately, we hope, for other things, other more creative things that we can do. So I think the problem is becoming addicted to the idea of whatever quick fix element you have in your life that you're obsessed with. I think instead what we want is a balance. So let's take advantage of the technology. Let's take advantage of it to free up time and get off the hamster wheel and to really take care of each other and to nourish each other in ways that accentuate our creativity and our fulfillment in life, because that's really what we ultimately want. And so many of the positions that you might get into as a leader, you want to recognize all of these things at once. This really is leadership from a 21st century perspective, is recognizing the benefits of the technology, but not becoming addicted to the technology. Recognizing that sending somebody a quick Twitter message is helpful, but to not become dependent on Twittering people at the expense of having interpersonal, deeper, richer relationships with other people. And so the idea is that we're going to be fully in the present, and we're going to take advantage of the technology that we're creating, because this technology has really affected our world in terms of people being able to get some social justice going in countries that would normally be oppressed. This is already happening. The fact that somebody can photograph something on their cell phone that's happening out in the world as an injustice and send that around the world is actually creating an amazing ability for everybody to be involved and support human rights. And at the same time, you and I, Mark, talked recently about how we sometimes meet people where all they want to do is text. And so then they become shut down and their interpersonal relationships become less fulfilling. And so there's an overdependence at times on the technology. Does that answer the question somewhat, do you think?
Well, I don't think there is a one sentence answer to this, because clearly it's starting with perhaps this symposium and the book, and there's obviously other movements and other people, you know, pushing forward to change the way that society works. I think, you know, there's not a quick fix to the quick fix mentality, let's put it like that. I was interested obviously to read in your in the chapter that during your time at Apache Springs and since then, that you've had a whole range of different people come through the doors to take advantage of the kind of education and help that you were giving. I'm reading here, for example, educators, counselors, clergy, trauma survivors, parents, teens, artists, engineers, entrepreneurs, returning soldiers. Now, clearly, there are leaders in each of these walks of life. So what was your overall experience with people coming in to an environment with horses, whereby, you know, horses were completely new to them. What was the sort of general reaction, and was there kind of skepticism, or what was it like? How did people react initially?
People are just completely thrilled being around the horses. There's something about a horse that breaks down your barriers to learning something new. They're just so delightful and so powerful and so graceful and so beautiful and so gentle all at the same time. It actually opens people up and lets them explore new ways of interacting and new ways of learning in a way that brings the idea of awe and pleasure into the learning process. And everyone that's come here, they may be skeptical in the beginning, but the minute they start interacting with the horses, their delight is visible on their faces. And something about being in a positive mood when you're learning something allows you to learn it faster. It sort of breaks down your own internal barriers to trying something new. And so I've just seen tremendous leaps forward from people coming here to study with horses. Now, one of the things that's essential to our program, the Epona program, is that when we bring in amateurs to work with horses, they work with horses that are trained to do this work, that are trustworthy, and that know how to challenge people perhaps while also remaining safe. And we also spend a large amount of time bringing new horses into the work who get to experience a number of different activities that we do with people, and we see which activities these horses really excel at, and we see if the horse is even oriented to work with different people, because there are some horses that are kind of like people. They're kind of like loners, and they're not maybe even at just this stage in the horse's life. What they really want is a single owner to focus all their attention on them, and so they're not necessarily good as teachers, just like some people are not as good as teachers. But the horses that we have are reaching out to people. They love their job. They, in some cases, have been healed by becoming a teacher. We have some horses who are abuse survivors who really just coddling them and walking on eggshells around them and giving them massages and all kinds of therapy and peace was not that effective for them. It was like their self-esteem raised and their true spirit came forward when they were seen as somebody who brought something unique into the world and that they could teach it to humans. It was like raised their self-esteem and created a total transformation.
And I guess that's the challenge, because as you say, when they come and they start working with the horses, the delight shows on their face straight away, and you know, we've all experienced it, regardless of whenever was the first time we met horses. But the challenge is, how do we do that now, and how do we...
Sorry, Mark. Let me cough for just a second. Okay. Thank you.
You all right?
Yes.
Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to ask that question again. So,
sounds good.
Okay. So you were saying that when people come and they first start to work with the horses, that they are suddenly, there's a certain joy that comes over them. And we've all experienced that when we first started working with horses and mixing with horses. So the challenge here is, how do we then spread that word and the message that we're talking about here, when at the same time, not everyone has access to horses or has access to horses that are suitably trained?
That's the purpose of this web symposium, is that not everybody does have access to horses right now. And some people get excited and they will travel to wherever the best regional training facility for this work is. And luckily we have a number of just Epona approved instructors with my own method around the world now who are available to teach. And then a lot of times people do come from Europe, Australia, South America to the Epona Center here in Arizona to study. And that's great when people can do that. But over the years, what I've learned is that there are some elements of horse wisdom, what they teach us about leadership, emotional intelligence, and social intelligence that can be translated into words and that can be taught in a classroom situation or, like we're doing now, over the Internet. So I think that there's a large amount that people can now learn from horse wisdom that's been kind of distilled out of direct experience with the herd and then brought into a human context and taught to humans that way. That's another reason why I created a project that I did with Kim McElroy, who's a marvelous horse artist, a few years back. It's a deck of horse wisdom cards called Way of the Horse, Equine Archetypes for Self-Discovery. And that was my goal with that card deck, was to create a situation where people could see evocative images of horses and also interact with horse wisdom in a nonlinear way so that you can kind of pick a card. And then there's a message and an essay that goes with it that talks about an aspect of horse wisdom. And my goal with that was, let's get this wisdom out to people who aren't in a position right now to have horses or are living in a big city and don't know where they can get to the nearest horse farm to study. And really, it's not just a matter of showing up at any horse farm and interacting with horses. You need to have an instructor that's willing to help you learn from the horses rather than simply dominate the horses or punish the horses or treat them like a machine. Because that kind of behavior is only going to reinforce the old habits of leadership that we're trying to change. Dominance and submission, aggression instead of assertiveness. People really need to learn to do something different. And that's what we're teaching here, is a different form of leadership for the 21st century.
Yeah, unfortunately, many of the so-called natural horsemanship teachers out there are still working on really on a case of oppression and dominance rather than assertiveness. And that's sad but true. I'd like to sort of move on now to talk about one of the items you mentioned, which is the equine philosophy. And I believe I picked this up from Ian, actually. He spoke about the commandments you use. Now, I've not come across these, but is this part of the Epona program, the Ten Commandments?
The Ten Commandments? I haven't seen that.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I picked that up from Ian, and I'd not come across it before in your work, and I just wonder whether, you know, obviously I don't know your work in the, but he said, obviously, one of them is equine philosophy, values relationship over territory. And it seemed like there was a raft of these. I'm going to probably struggle now to find that. So if Ian's listening in, and he could just maybe jot that on the question box, that would be great. And for example, there's this one section that he picks that he's mentioned here. It says, what we desperately need is enhancement and exemplification of this notion of relationship. It seems so much like Gandhi's notion of extending the concept of family to our fellow men. Strangely, many people's reaction to this at the time was that he was incredibly naive, and yet it does make perfect sense if we understand that diversity is the magic ingredient which makes possible adaptation to a changing world. So I wonder whether you could talk a little about this philosophy of relationship over territory.
We've had about 5,000 years of experimentation in various forms of leadership. And one of the main ones is force and dominance over collaboration. Collaboration is a little bit tougher in the beginning because it involves actually being willing to listen to others and collaborate and know how to have difficult discussions, which is going to be a big factor in this web symposium, is how can we have productive discussions about difficult topics? Because you can't collaborate unless you can do that. And so dominance and submission was just seen as, you know, who's ever stronger and most powerful or most charismatic can just order everybody else around. But over the last, just look at the last 50 years and see how that really doesn't work in the long run. I mean, we've just seen Gaddafi fall. We've seen a number of other leaders over the years who were really extreme, domineering, fear-producing leaders. The head of Enron is a really good example. The CEO, who was the CFO for many years, I can't think of his name right now, but Enron fell, Gaddafi fell. This kind of leadership doesn't work very long because it oppresses a large number of people to the point where they get to the place where they don't have anything to lose. And then they organize around a common enemy, and you just can't stand up to that many disenfranchised people over time. And what we've seen instead are Martin Luther King and Gandhi, who seem to be talking about something that, as you said, Mark, sounded naive, but in the long run, they created significant social change. Social change that happened during their lifetime. They sacrificed a lot for it, but, you know, ultimately the more dominant leaders sacrificed their lives too, and they're not going to have an influence on the future in the same way these really enlightened leaders are having. So we're seeing now, through numerous instances in history, that the dominant submission paradigm doesn't work, the power over doesn't work for very long, and that people who are really about teaching people to work together, to care for each other, and yet to learn how to be empowered. Because you can't just say, I'm going to care for everybody and lose sight of yourself, in the same way that a cell in your body may be part of a larger body, but that cell needs the ability to maintain its integrity. It needs a cell membrane in order to be of any use to the body at all, because if poisons overrun it and destroy it, it is of no use. So this is the paradox that horses teach us, is that we are part of a larger human race and a society, whatever society we're in, and a family, and we are an individual at the same time. And so what skills can we learn about maintaining our personal integrity and our personal power as we learn how to coordinate with the other cells in this body we call humanity?
And it seems to me that this all sort of goes back to this whole question of ego. And I've, you know, done some sort of personal development work over the past 10 or so years. And one comes across this notion of ego and the fact that the man's ego won't allow him to do this or that or the other, or is telling him to do this or that or the other. And it seems like one needs to get out of the way of the ego. I mean, I know that there are, you know, strong horses and dominant horses, but it seems like they don't have that issue with ego that humans seem to.
I think the difficult part about the ego is it's not, that word is not specific enough to what the real difficulty is or the real challenge is. So at Epona over the years, I've watched this element, and I realized that what the problem with the ego is not that it's a container for promoting self-esteem in the world and allowing you to stand up and have some personal integrity. That's the healthy part of the ego. The destructive part of the ego is what I've grown to call the false self. I didn't come up with this term. This has like been used throughout history, the idea of the false self versus the authentic self. The false self is simply a collection of habits. And so if you want to think in terms of modern technology, let's think about a computer. Your ego, false self, the destructive aspects of it, are just like a bunch of computer programs that you put on your computer that for some reason take on their own identity, but they can't function outside their limited programming. And so if you identify as the programs, you're going to have a lot of trouble in life. You're not going to want to try new things. You're going to see as everything that's new that falls outside of your little box, your little program, as threatening. But if you instead say, okay, well, those are programs. Those are useful habits in some situations, and in others, they don't quite measure up. So I'm not the programs. I'm the programmer. And not only am I the programmer, because I don't want to have to reinvent the wheel every time I need to do something new, I'm the person who can decide to import new programs for new situations. So you have to stop thinking, you have to stop allowing yourself to identify with the habits you've learned in the past. That's where you get into trouble. And everybody has different programs. You could actually spend a little time this afternoon, everyone who's listening to this call, and write a list of all the different programs that are on your hard drive. That would include, for me, one of the programs I got was growing up in a family of Eastern European immigrants who had, you know, had problems with the Cossacks and had come over here with $5 in their pockets because something really awful happened to them. So when they came here, their mentality was you can't trust anyone outside the family. And so that's one of the programs that was handed down to me two generations later. Don't trust anyone outside the family. And, yeah, that was useful for people who were under siege in Eastern Europe during the Russian Revolution, but it's not relevant to me now. So I can say, okay, that's if I ever think that, I can say, well, that's my Eastern European grandparents' program leading into the situation. Is it relevant? Can I trust this particular person? And if not, it's time for me to bring in some kind of new program that has to do with maybe learning a little bit about a different culture or a different perspective this new person is bringing to me. So you can have programs also associated with what women do, what men do, depending on when you were raised and when you were born and what country you were in. You know, men don't cry. That can be a part of your program. It can be very destructive over time if you can't cry under certain circumstances. Nice girls don't get angry, you know, or it's unevolved to get angry. As we'll learn, anger has a very important message and can be used constructively. So if you could just take a little time today and write down all of your programs, like you're almost seeing all the programs on your computer, and then you can recognize when a program is kicking in and say, is this relevant now? And then the part of you that can say yes or no, or let me bring in a new program, or let me create a new program, that's the authentic part of who you are. The other part is just a collection of habits. Does that make any sense, Mark?
Absolutely, it makes sense. It makes complete sense, and that's something that I've experienced myself. But I think most of us are walking around with all this baggage, and we're not really aware of it, and that's part of the issue. You, as you say, they are just habits, and you've always done it that way, or you've always thought that, and it's not until you get seriously challenged, and I don't mean in an aggressive way, but someone seriously makes you stop and think, that you think, oh, wait a minute, where did that come from? How long have I been carrying that around? And it's not easy, and it does take a while. And that's a very good point there about the fact that these are programs, and it's the subconscious that's really driving us, and that they are buried down there. I couldn't agree more. I love the phrase that you use at one point where you say, your body is the horse that your mind...
Hey, Mark, yeah? You're kind of breaking up on me, and I just wonder if anybody else is noticing that.
If people would just like to say whether they can... okay, Ian's reply, which is good. Am I still robotic for everyone?
give it another try. Say a few more words.
Well, I shall come back to Ian's point then. So Ian's written in. Thank you, Ian, for following it up. She says, Linda comes up with guiding principles, which I suggest might be put together as basic commandments. Oh, that was your idea, Ian. Thank you. The example I gave was tap, not tax. So I was looking for an expansion of this type of approach, a basic set of rules and commandments. So am I robotic still?
Yeah, Ian, Mark. Mark, it's the sound is breaking up so much and you're sounding so robotic. I'm having trouble hearing what you're saying. And I was so excited on the track that you were on, too.
Okay. So, well, listen, you keep talking.
Okay.
And if you can, did you get that question from Ian then?
No, not quite.
Okay. Let me repeat it for you.
Okay.
And then you can answer it while I just dial back in.
Okay.
Okay, so Ian is saying, Linda comes up with guiding principles, which he's suggesting you put together as some sort of basic framework commandments. The example that he gave was tap, not tax. So he was wondering whether there was a series of these type of commandments. So whilst you answer that, I'm going to cut myself out and dial back in.
Okay. Well, Ian, I've really been enjoying your emails and all of the points that you bring up and the reflections that you have. We're also getting a little bit of sound here.
Okay. So I'm back. It should be better now.
Give it another try. Because I didn't hear the whole question that Ian had. I didn't hear the very end of it.
Okay. Sorry about this, folks. It's just that the recording quality is so much better. So, so I was just saying that Ian had written him saying you come up with these guiding principles, one of which is tap, not tax. And the other one, of course, was the one we looked at earlier, which is the equine philosophy of values, the values relationship over territory. And he was kind of looking forward to maybe a set of these guiding principles or commandments, as he called them.
Well, that's a really interesting idea, is to create a set of guiding principles based on what I've learned from horses. So, yes, one of them would be relationship over territory, and another would be learning how to tap resources, not tax them. And actually, that is something that I noticed about really great horsemen over the years, from Alexander the Great to George Washington. Both of them had this ability to ride the same horse into battle year after year after year. So they knew how to tap their equine resources without taxing them. In other words, their horse was not something that they just allowed to be shot out from under them, or they ran into the ground and then got a new horse. They actually valued that particular horse. Alexander the Great had a horse named Bucephalus that he rode into almost every battle he ever fought. And when the horse was lost one time, he issued an edict that he would kill everyone in the kingdom unless this horse was brought back to him. I really hope that he wasn't going to stand behind that threat, but knowing him, he might have. But anyways, he got his horse back. So George Washington rode the same two horses into battle year after year after year during the Revolutionary War. One of them was named Blueskin, and the other one, I forget his name at the moment. I'll think of it in a minute. But these men, I think, survived in battle because they also learned to depend on a horse that was of an exceptional talent. And so they recognized exceptional talent in their horses and relied on those horses' sensitivity and their ability to stand up to the intensity of being in battle. Remember that it is against every hardwired impulse in a horse to go anywhere near the scent of blood, let alone into a raging battle with horses screaming on the battlefield. That's what used to happen. And in George Washington's time, there was cannon fire besides that. So when George found the right horse that would go into battle and be able to sit through all of that, and we'll be talking more about that in future chapters, he was going to tap those resources. They were valuable to him. That horse was a valuable asset to him, and had an integrity of his own, and he put his trust in that horse. And boy, I can tell you right now that we're getting to the point where we don't even do that with people anymore, let alone horses. A lot of horses in this world are considered to be kind of like throwaway animals. I'm just working today on trying to rescue a horse in that situation. He threw somebody, and his life is now seriously in danger for throwing somebody once. So anyways, we're trying to work together to rescue this particular horse. But in any case, we do this with people now. Ian, you brought up a book that I did look up, as it turns out, about a kind of modern form of slavery where people are considered disposable. And so, boy, we've really lost a lot of ground compared to someone like Alexander the Great or George Washington, who saw their horses as being beings of integrity with real value. And now we've gotten to the point where we just treat people as if they're disposable. So tapping resources without taxing them, first of all, requires that you actually see the other being as more than a resource, as someone with integrity, with talent that you value, something that you're going to develop over time without developing it too quickly or under too much stress. And so we learn to do that in really fine horse training, because you don't push a horse too far too quickly, or you actually can get injuries that then A very talented horse no longer is useful. If you had just given him a little more time and taken a little more patience and developed his muscles slowly, then he might be the horse that takes you to the Olympics. But the quick fix mentality and using a horse as a machine actually causes you to tax these resources too soon. And like I say, we do this with people. So we have to learn how to do something different as leaders in our communities, in our families, and in our place of business. And the place to start is to recognize that you are not going to treat another being as disposable.
Yeah, and so it would be great if you could come up with a list of these. I remember, it's probably it's not going to mean a lot to a lot of people. Maybe Ian might resonate with this or Susan. The British Lions rugby team, they went out to South Africa and they did a lot of sort of team bonding before they went out, because rugby, a bit like American football, is very much a team game. And they came up with these guiding principles, and they had them all printed on sort of like playing card sized pieces of cards which were laminated. And they carried them around. It didn't just apply to the matches. It applied throughout the whole of their time away in South Africa. And they all adhered to these principles, and they won the series. And it was just a really simple, quick checklist. You know, am I doing what I said I'd do, kind of thing. And obviously very, very effective for that. So maybe that's something we'll develop over the course of the symposium, is a series of these principles as we work our way through the chapters, which would be great.
I think that's just a brilliant idea. Thank you so much, Ian, and thank you, Mark, for bringing this up. And I think it could be a really fun project for those of us who are in this symposium, is to create the Power of the Herd Web Symposium Guiding Principles based on the material as you read it. If you are reading the material and you say, this element here would make a great guiding principle, something like relationship over territory can be one of the guiding principles. Tapping resources without taxing them can be one of the guiding principles. And as you read through the material, you might formulate something that you see as important into a guiding principle, and we can create this all together. And actually, whatever we create by March 1st, I could even get into the book and thank everybody who's contributed. So this book is still in progress. The deadline is March the 1st. And so any new insights that we come up with, including this list of guiding principles, can be something that the Power of the Herd Web Symposium has worked together to create and gets credit for it.
Fabulous, fabulous. I'm loving this. Okay, so what I'll do then is I'll put a special page on the website for these, so as there is a one place where they can all go as opposed to being dotted around. So I'll send an email out about that. But for those who are obviously on the call now or listening to the replay when you do, then you will that's where you'll go to put your guiding principle. That's a terrific idea. And if then you put a where, you know, which chapter or which page or which paragraph or whatever, so at least there's some reference to it. We know exactly what you're talking about. Oh, how exciting. Okay.
And if you would like some credit for this, please put your first and last name there. If not, just whatever name you would like to be credited with. Because some people might even be reading the material and it may cause them to think of something else that's not even directly in the material. And so we'd like to give you credit for that as well if it shows up in the book.
Yeah, Larry agrees. A set of guiding principles you can carry around with you on a card would be great. Okay, so I want to ask you now, one of the, obviously you went through some tough times at Apache Springs I'm going to have to clear my throat. Hang on a second, folks. Took a schluck of water and it went down the wrong way. Okay, so you said I employed the valuable services of an executive coach and read every leadership book I could get my hands on, and I learned a lot in the process. However, the most innovative tools came from working with the horses. So again, for those people who are not familiar with working with horses, can you maybe give some examples of those kind of insights that you received?
Well, There's a whole lot that we learn as humans at an intellectual level, where we take in intellectual information. And I don't want to slight the power of this. It's not something we want to let go of. But when you look at a statistic that comes up that more or less 10% of human communication is verbal, what those studies mean is that when people are interacting with each other, 10% of their communication is verbal. This doesn't really go for when I write a message on Twitter that says, you know, clean your room. There's no nonverbal elements to that whatsoever. But in interpersonal communications, only 10% of what the messages you're sending back and forth are verbal. And that goes with the rest of your life with yourself and your intellectual life. You need to not just learn things at an intellectual verbal level, but you need to actually embody them. And horses help you embody that other 90%, that other 90% that lies in the nonverbal realm. It's really hard for people to exercise the nonverbal elements of communication and education and embodying what's intellectual. Horses are masters at teaching you to do this. Horses are paying attention to that other 90% at a heightened level because they're animals that are preyed upon in nature. So they have like a heightened volume. Their volume on that is turned way up, volume on body language, on intention, on focus, on assertiveness versus aggression, on micromanaging versus seeing what's needed and give it and then going back to a place of collaboration. Horses teach all of these things in the most efficient way possible. And so one of the challenges I had as a leader at some of these places that I developed and worked at over the years, both in the horse facilitated learning program and in other areas of my life where I was a leader, was that I had to develop the ability to be a leader, the ability to be assertive without being aggressive or micromanaging. And I really didn't learn that until I started working with horses. And so I often use an example that I worked at a rather dysfunctional radio station for a while, and it was owned by the communications department of a major university, and yet there was very little actual communication going on there. And so, I mean, that's one of the ironies in working in radio, is that it's all about communication, and yet a lot of the things that go on behind the microphone have little to do with communication. And so I had a boss that was, I was a classical announcer at a radio station, and I had a boss that was really aggressive and shut down and just wanted to bark out rules and couldn't stand any kind of interpersonal interaction whatsoever. And he was forcing me into a situation where I was having to work on all of the holidays because I don't have any kids, and I volunteered to work on holidays at times. But then it got to the point where it was expected, and then the one time I really wanted to take a holiday off because I had a friend coming to town, it was then required of me. And so at the time, I was working with my first horse. This was in the early 1990s, and I had been learning how to be actually assertive with a principle I'm going to tell you about here today in a moment, how to be assertive progressively, starting at a low volume and getting to a higher volume. So in music, we would call that a crescendo. You start soft, and then you get progressively louder. And if you do this with assertiveness, you can use assertiveness in a really effective way, because a lot of times we're not assertive, we're asking please, and then all of a sudden we get really pissed off, and then we overdo it. So horses teach you to up your power and your assertiveness in terms of a crescendo, almost like a dial going from 1 to 8, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7. And if 8 works, then you just back off and relax and enjoy what's happening. I didn't learn that until I worked with horses. And so when I used this principle of assertiveness, and again, I was in a disempowered position. I was an announcer, and this was my boss. And I was saying no to him. I was not going to work. And I just upped the ante with what I had learned with a horse, both in my body language and my tone of voice and what I was saying. And I got this guy to back off and do exactly what I was saying. And he had somebody to work for me in 5 minutes. And when he came in with me again to ask me to work on another holiday, he was so gentle and accommodating and sweet. So that's real power. When you can stand up to your own boss and you can use principles that you learned with horses to completely turn the situation around to your advantage. I mean, you could misuse this as well, but if you have some integrity, boy, this can allow you to become a leader in situations where you aren't even the obvious leader.
And so I've had, obviously, some experience with horses. And when I was learning, I remember I was taught to really sort of bring my energy up. I wasn't raising my voice or making wild movements or anything like that. But I was told to raise the energy and the intention behind what I was doing. And so is that what we're talking about here? Is that what you actually did in that situation? Because I really want people to understand what that looks like, what that feels like, what that sounds like in a work or in a group environment.
Yeah, I've been working a lot on how to translate this idea of raising your power as a crescendo or dialing it up in human context. I mean, it is by far the easiest thing to learn when you're working with horses. The horses really help you exercise that. And when you can dial your power up with somebody who weighs 1,000 pounds and has a mind of his own, you can definitely do this with your boss or your teenage son or, as I like to say, your feisty little wife or any person that is trying to control your behavior or manipulate you in some way. Just dial your power up. And
what does
hopefully
that look
you're
like?
Going to use
what
it
does,
well.
What does dial your power look like? If people have not come across, obviously we're dealing in an audio medium here. But if people aren't, if people don't know what that looks like, feels like, can you describe that a little bit more, perhaps?
Yes, I can, and this may be the first time I'm going to do it.
Give it a
so
shot.
You have to give me a little cut me a little slack here. But what it looks like is, let's say you Twitter your teenage son, clean your room. And you don't really get a response. And so a lot of people would just keep Twittering him, clean your room, clean your room, clean your room. But that's like staying at a one because that's not in person. There's no communication happening other than at the most basic level of, you know, barking off some kind of order on an electronic device. So you just consider that a one on your power level. What you have to do is once you decide that you're committed to being assertive, you cannot back down for a second. You just have to slowly and methodically increase the power. So you don't say, clean your room on Twitter, and then clean your room on Twitter, and then clean your room on Twitter, and then give up, and then a week later explode at him. That's what people normally do when they don't know how to turn their power up. So you have to commit. Once I start at a one, I'm going to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 until I get it done. Okay, so you Twitter, clean your room. He doesn't respond. Maybe you give him one more chance. Or maybe you Twitter instead, why have you not cleaned your room? And see if he answers. And maybe he gives you some lame excuse. But at least now he's communicating back with you. Okay, so that maybe you raised it up to a 1.5 there. So then the next thing you're going to do is you're going to encounter him in person, and you're going to say, John, I really need you to clean your room, and I need you to tell me when you're going to do it. So now you're up to a 3. You're actually asking him when he's going to do it. You're getting a commitment from him. Now, as we know with teenage sons, that that probably isn't going to work either. He's going to give you a bunch of excuses. I have a math test, and, you know, my girlfriend and I are going to a dance this weekend. And, okay, well, John, tell me when you can do it. Well, I think I could do it next Wednesday. I don't really have much going on, and the math test will be over. Okay, so then you see Wednesday comes along, and if you want to, you can just see if he cleans his room, or you can just be there on Wednesday and then even reinforce it. Okay, Tom or John, today's the day you're going to clean your room. And actually, let me help you get started. So now you've even turned it up to a 4 or 5 because you're a motivating factor and you're actually walking into his room with him and helping him get started. So that actually may be even a 5 or a 6, but it's a real good-natured, collaborative form of power. And then if he doesn't, you're just going to progressively up it until perhaps, you know, the car's taken away, there's no access to the Internet, but the split second that he cleans his room, here's the key you have to engage, and this is what horses teach you, is you don't just want to go neutral and say, you should have been doing this all along. Because this doesn't give you long-term motivational power. What you really need to do is the split second he does what you ask is to give him immediate positive feedback. You know, you don't have to get on your knees and say, oh, thank you for cleaning your room. Instead, you can just say, oh, right, you're cleaning your room. Okay. So what do you want for dinner? I'll fix you something nice for dinner. So that if he sees that you're willing to up your power progressively and the split second he does what you ask, you immediately give him a feeling of engagement and connection rather than just disgust and disengagement and you, this is your job and you live under my roof. If you give immediate positive feedback, then the next time you ask for something, you're already ahead of the game. So that's crescendoing and then giving immediate positive feedback. But it also involves commitment, because once you are committed to being assertive, you better not back down. You better not go from a 3 back down to a 1 again. It's just progressive all the way up to the top and then immediate positive feedback. That's exactly what works with horses in getting them to move in the round pen. And it absolutely works with people.
Now, there you go, folks. Now, I think that's just an absolutely perfect example. And this is something that anybody can understand. Now, for those of you who have worked with horses for a long time, you know exactly how that works. But let me ask you, I wonder whether you've actually done that with a human. And if you haven't, then now you know how to do it because you've been doing it with your horse. And for those who've not involved with horses at all, there you go. That's the formula. I'm sure as we work through the book and work through other chapters, we're going to be coming across other examples like this. And I would ask you, Linda, really to if you can provide those sort of examples, that's precisely the tools that people are going to be able to understand and latch onto. That, thank you. That was a wonderful, wonderful example. Didn't you think, folks?
Well, and this was a great time to ask me this, because I just had an apprenticeship class here last week and I came up with a little handout about this. And I actually came up with a formula, like a mathematical formula. And let me see if I can remember it. It's motivation equals commitment plus crescendo plus immediate positive feedback. Okay, so motivation equals commitment plus crescendo plus immediate positive feedback, in that order. And if you can do that, what you're going to get is people being more interested in cooperating with you, knowing that you're not going to back down, you're going to up the power in a very methodical, thoughtful way, and they're going to get greater connection with you afterwards and a feeling of satisfaction and camaraderie. People will do anything for you after a while.
Wow. Motivation equals commitment plus crescendo plus immediate positive feedback. I've written it down here. Again, I think if we can collect these as we go along our journey here in the symposium, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I think we've probably got some time for some questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to check whether there's anything there I really wanted to tap into. Yeah, there's one more the question I wanted to ask you, and it's this. You're saying about deep, it's under the heading of deep peace, and you're saying instead of fixating on what should or shouldn't happen, horses sense what is happening and what wants to happen. Now, I think that thought of what wants to happen, that concept, is something that's totally alien to 99.999% of humans, I would think. So explain what that means. Horses sense what is happening and what wants to happen.
I think this web symposium would be a good example in the human world. So if I had been fixating on what should or shouldn't happen, when we did our initial interview where you asked me to be on another website, the Horse Conscious website, and do an interview about my horse Rasa and her influence on my work and what it was like to lose her because she passed away recently. If I had gotten on that call and thought about what should or shouldn't happen on this call, I wouldn't have been as engaged with the questions that were coming in that were going, quote unquote, off topic, because we ended up having this amazing conversation about the nature of creativity and what horses have to teach us about creativity. And if I had been fixated on this call, I have a list of things I want to talk about and a bunch of things that, you know, we shouldn't talk about because they're off topic. we wouldn't have had those amazingly inspiring calls. And if I had been in that mindset, I would not have been able to sense what was happening there and then what wanted to happen. So what was happening on that first call is that the people who were listening to the call and sending in questions were deeply interested in creativity and how to engage creativity in their life. And what that told me, too, is that this is an incredibly sophisticated audience. What's happening here is there's an incredibly sophisticated group of people on this call about rasa, and we're going way off topic here in some sense, but it's just so fascinating and exciting about what influence a horse can have on human lives, and then what wants to happen. Well, we didn't get to cover everything in that first call about rasa, so we said, well, let's create a second call. That wanted to happen based on what people were doing and how great of a response we had. And then another thing that wanted to happen was that the way that you and I, Mark, were interacting and the way that you were able to act as ringleader to bring in all of these amazing people and be the monitor of all of these calls and questions and respond to them as well in the moment. And we thought, well, what wants to happen here? Why don't we do, you know, something else? Why don't we build on this interest? And an element of what wanted to happen for a long time was that people had been telling me that I should be doing some kind of a web thing, and they weren't very specific about what that was. Just get on the web and do something exciting and share your knowledge, whatever you can speak about horses and how they help people. And so then I thought, well, I'm writing this leadership book, and I have a lot of concepts and principles now that I teach in classrooms to people on site at their businesses, and then they come out and work with the horses after they get some initial classroom training. And so why can't I do that on a website to people all around the world? So that's an example of not fixating on what should or shouldn't happen and then sensing what was happening and then, based on that, what wanted to happen. So this web symposium is a perfect example of that dynamic.
And so how does that balance with the idea of fixating on a goal, or are we saying it's about the journey, not the goal?
Well, sometimes you have a goal, and when you notice, we do an exercise that actually we train in our, we teach this pretty specifically in our apprenticeship now. So just about any opponent instructor knows this. It's called embodying the goal. And what it involves is learning some basic opponent principles about how to use your body as a sensing device, a tuner and receiver and amplifier for information, and then how to read your horse's body language and intentions at the same time. And sometimes we send people in with horses and let the horse and the person in the moment come up with the agenda and the theme, and we follow that. So that would be a pretty simple example of what is happening and what once happened. But sometimes you actually have to perform a goal that's given to you from the outside in order to be successful in life. And so a lot of times when we have a set goal, then we lose all contact with the body and the emotions and the response the other beings are having as we perform this goal together. And so you can actually learn over time to have a set goal, a functional goal. Like an example would be to go in with a horse and have him walk once around the arena, trot once around the arena, change directions, and walk and trot in the other direction. Okay, so yeah, that's a goal that's been imposed by the outside. I may be sending you into a round pen to do this with a horse. But when you go in there and you're interacting with the horse, you're going to notice what is happening. Are you really effective with the directions that you're given? And if so, can you dial up and practice the crescendo and get that horse moving? And then when he does move from a walk to the trot, can you give him that immediate positive feedback before you move on to the next element of the goal so that the horse feels like you're in cahoots together and you're having some success together? So, it's not all about just amorphous, let's feel a goal today and let's just do that. Sometimes you have to have a real goal and function and move forward together with a group of people, but you can still notice who understands this or who's having some tension about performing this goal? Is it because they lack training or they lack confidence? Would it be better for another person to perform this aspect of the goal because they are actually more experienced and more comfortable with this piece? Okay, let's switch who's doing what here. That's about being responsive in the moment as you're also working together to perform a goal. And sometimes what wants to happen in that situation is that the person who was charged with doing a certain aspect of the goal, who doesn't have the right training or is nervous about it, what wants to happen is to pick the person who has more experience and who is more enthusiastic about that part of the goal. What wants to happen is to switch the leadership roles in that situation. So those are examples. Does that make any sense, Mark?
Yeah, it does. Something that Larry's written in to say, it's maybe a dumb question, but isn't what Linda is teaching us not a form of cathedral thinking? And maybe this is what wants it to happen here. So I think that's what you were really saying about the symposium. Okay, I'd like to thank all the people who've written in. I'm afraid I won't be able to cover some of the questions because they are on topic, off topic, and I'm trying to stay on topic. So, for example, Tara and Sandra and Leanne, they are kind of slightly off topic if I've understood your question correctly. So I'd like to try and keep to the ones that are sort of are pertinent to this.
Now I'm really curious. Now I just have to hear the questions.
Really? No, honestly.
I might even be able to tell you at what point in the what chapter they'll come up or be a the.
No, don't worry.
Okay,
We can save them. I'll send them to you. Don't worry.
Okay, you've got to send them to me. Okay, I have to know what they are at least.
Oh, so we know that curiosity is a big thing for Mrs. Kohanov here.
It's
anyway.
Terrible. I'm terrible with even, you know, creating surprises for people because I can't stand it. So
now we know something new and we didn't before. Okay, so let's the questions. So Ian has you talk in the book about obviously the issues you had at Apache Springs and how the economic crisis really didn't help the situation there. And this is kind of this question is kind of close to the bone, and I don't mean that unkindly to either side, but he's asking, what does Linda now know that could have prevented such a personal organizational crash and meet current needs more effectively? So what do you know now that you didn't know then that could have helped, I think is what
you're trying to say. There's a lot of things. There's a whole lot of things, which is part of the reason why I wanted to start this web symposium and write this book on leadership is to so that everybody doesn't have to go into these situations learning from the ground up the things that were perplexing to me that I hadn't read in other leadership books before. One of the things is that the interpersonal element in people learning how to function together and get along and work on a common goal was a big challenge that I wasn't expecting. Because what I was doing was I was bringing in people who were all different experts in their fields, who essentially knew more about their jobs than I did, okay? But a lot of these people had also been out developing their own businesses for a long time where they were the master in charge of whatever area they were really good at. And so having a bunch of innovative, masterful people come together to work toward a common goal was really hard. And it doesn't take away from anybody's mastery of their own element of their job or why I invited them to be a part of the organization. It's just that in our culture, we come from a dominance and submission culture, and you're either in charge or you're subservient, or either you are the teacher or you are the student. And when you have a bunch of teachers coming together, who run their own businesses to create a whole new business together, it was a big challenge. There was no real precedent for a lot of what we were doing. And that's when I became really interested in emotional and social intelligence and realized that, one of the people I studied with that was very helpful that I'm almost positive that he will be willing to come on and do a call with us on this Power of the Herd website is a man by the name of Bob Wall. And I did do some coaching with him at certain points and learned a lot from him. In fact, the difficult conversation piece was very much inspired by some things I learned from him. So at some point, I'm going to have Bob Wall on the call. He wrote a book called Coaching for Emotional Intelligence. And he said, he likes to say that high IQ and training, and in this case, I would say innovation and brilliance and genius, get you into the arena. But high emotional and social intelligence help you win the game. And that was really the thing, is that we didn't have the emotional and social intelligence skills for groups of experts and innovators to come together and be highly functional just off the spur of the moment. That was the learning edge for us. And so a lot of what I'm sharing in this book is exactly the skills that you need to have and that you need to teach to your employees if you're going to do something really ambitious. Does that help answer the question at this point, do you think, Mark, or should I go more in depth?
Yes, I'm not sure it really covers it because, I just want to say one thing. Someone's asked whether this is supposed to run for an hour. Yes, it is supposed to run for an hour, and I realize we're already at 70 minutes, but I think what we just need to sort of tidy off this question because I would like to hear it answered a little more fully, and perhaps you guys do as well. Yeah, I mean, you were saying that obviously these sort of entrepreneurs were all brought together. They're obviously one-man bands or part of small organizations that came together under this larger umbrella, and you didn't have the emotional and social intelligence to deal with the situation. As you were the figurehead of that organization, what would you have done differently?
Well, another thing I needed to do was be a stronger leader. This was hard for me because I was hiring a bunch of people to come together who were who knew more about their jobs than I did. So I was trying to be respectful of what they knew and to have them come together and collaborate. But it just what was happening is that it wasn't easy for people to do that. And some people needed different skills. Skills involving collaboration, skills involving how to have productive and respectful, difficult conversations with each other. I didn't know what those tools were. I only found them over time as I noticed that this was a problem. But at the same time, what I really needed to do was not say, you guys are all experts, you know more than I do. What I needed to do instead was say, okay, you know, you can collaborate and get along, and if you aren't, I'm stepping in. And I'm taking over, and I'm going to run this three-ring circus here. And at times, I just waited too long to step into that leadership role because I was in awe of their talents. And so what I realized is that when you're a leader of a group of people who know more about their jobs than you do, you still have to be the leader. You can cut them some slack. You can let them experiment a little bit. But if you let it go on too long, then it creates disruptions that cost you time and money over time. The other thing is that I realized that I, as the leader, had to also be an educator. I had to educate people with the emotional and social intelligence skills they needed in order to collaborate. And a lot of those skills I didn't know myself. I had a natural ability to get along with people, but I didn't realize what was easy for me was not necessarily easy for the next person. And so I had to notice, what does it take for people to collaborate and be mutually respectful and be able to air differences productively? And it took me like 2 or 3 years to figure out what those skills were and then to create a program where that was immediately taught to everybody who walked in the door. Mm. And a lot of these skills weren't available in any of the books I was reading. So it took me years to find the skills. And a lot of the interpersonal communication models that came from the counseling sphere were not effective. And it took me a while to realize that. So I would even bring in counselors to handle these difficulties, and the tools that they were bringing in were not effective for people in a business situation. They were more effective for families working out something or another. So they weren't translatable to the business world. So I needed to realize that the old counseling models, for instance, people sitting around and saying, when you do this, I feel that, that doesn't work at all. It just creates situations where a business meeting turns into an encounter group, and you never get anything done. And then it causes all this feeling of the personal and professional being enmeshed in these weird ways. So what I had to do was find out, if we're not going to do that, then what are we going to do? And so a lot of this book is written about the skills that I needed, that I wish I had, that I hope to hand to you so that you never have to go through what I went through. Because I walked around for years as this organization grew to an international level, in a state of shock constantly, because people would do things interpersonally that I couldn't believe, and I didn't know how to handle when I would see it. And so I would be shocked. And so now I'm not so shocked anymore. I mean, I still have some of the same interpersonal difficulties and lack of collaboration happening, for instance, in some of the apprenticeship groups that go through. But now I know the tool to give people right away. And because of the fact that I'm not shocked, my calmness is contagious to others, which immediately calms the entire situation down. So what I'm going to teach people in this web symposium is a bunch of things that might shock you, and then what to do with that situation instead. What are the tools that people need to move forward in this empowered position where everybody has the potential to be a leader? And based on that, you're going to be so much calmer in situations where there's some kind of interpersonal difficulty. Now, there was another element that had to do with the economy, because we were doing well. And then when the economy tanked, our income was suddenly cut in half. And I had invested everything I owned. I didn't have any money to float me during an economic crisis like a larger corporation might. So, for instance, a lot of the local hotels, they, like, our business cut in half suddenly, and their business was cut down, you know, 70%, but they had an international organization behind them of investors who floated them and kept their doors open. They may have had to lay people off, but they had some money to float, and I had no money to float. I put everything on the line for this. And the other thing is I did have another investor, and he was not interested in collaboration with others so much. So that became a hurdle too, because we could have brought in other investors early on, but he would resist that notion at every step of the way. So by the time the economy tanked, all the investors that I could have brought in to float us, I had already turned them away. And this is what we face all the time, because a lot of times the people who are funders or investors, they don't have the interpersonal skills to collaborate either. And they don't really want to. And so then how do you work with somebody like that to allow them to work with others? And how do you make that interesting to them when they're in a position of power over you, essentially? So these are all elements that were involved.
Oh, that's fascinating. I think that everyone can see the benefit. I mean, just through this conversation, the benefit of being part of the symposium and obviously the book itself when it comes out. I think, as you say, we're going to be streets ahead. And for those who do have horses, what would be interesting for me to, and Linda too, to read about is whether you perhaps have not been putting your horse skills to work with humans. If you started to do that now and started to use that sort of assertiveness, if it's required, out in your everyday life away from the horses, what sort of impact you have. So, you know, using Linda's model of commitments, crescendo, and immediate positive feedback, I mean, I think it's all, I'm very excited personally about where this is going. I mean, this, again, one gets into something, as you say, and suddenly it takes off and you don't know which direction it's going to go, and I think it's very exciting, and I hope everyone listening thinks the same too. So with that, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today, and of course I'd like to thank Linda for her wonderful contributions here. So thank you, Linda. I hope you enjoyed the call.
Thank you, Mark. I really enjoyed it, and thanks to all of you who've written in. I've been really enjoying your letters. I'm not in a position to answer as much as I would like to because I'm trying to finish the book, but I definitely read everybody's entries, and I so much like the Meet the Herd section that you created, Mark, because you didn't tell me you were going to do that, and that's a place where all of the people who are on the symposium can introduce themselves to each other. And Mark, I don't know if you know this or not, but one of the big early pieces in our Epona approach techniques, one piece that we teach all of our apprentices to engage is an activity called Meet the Herd.
I didn't know that, honestly.
So, and that's exactly what we do, is we have people meet our herd in a very specific way where they learn some new skills about gathering information in unfamiliar situations. And that's kind of what the Meet the Herd page on our website is doing. So thanks for creating that, Mark. It was a really nice surprise.
Well, that came out of an email conversation I'd had with Ian. So thanks to him too. So that worked out great. And people have also been very good in making sure that the sort of general how do you do chit chat conversation goes on there, and then the actual discussion is happening on the chapter page. So that's terrific. So to let everyone know, I shall be putting up the replay as soon as I can, possibly even later today. So thanks again for everyone for tuning in. And if you didn't manage to hear it live, I hope you've enjoyed this replay when you listen to it. And thank you to Linda. And we shall be in touch again with more information, more details on what's coming up, the next call and the next chapter and so on and so forth. So just keep an eye on your emails. And I'd like to wish you all the rest of an enjoyable day, and we shall speak soon. Unfortunately, we can't open up the lines to say hi and bye, but I'm sure that you're with us in spirit. In fact, I can feel it. Okay, Linda, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Catch you next time. Bye, everyone. Bye.